Hello and welcome to Connected, the Sunday Business Post Technology Podcast brought to you in association with Dell EMC. I'm Emmett Ryan, and yeah, it's been a while, folks, because we've had to basically reorganize a lot of stuff, as anyone who actually pays attention to how the whole actual place we work in works, there's been a lot of movement. We've changed boss, changed owner, and changed location. And a change of location means we actually are offsite today because we weren't sure at the time of arranging the interview with today's guest where we actually were going to be podcast-wise with the new office. The good news is the studio's up and running in the new office. It's all good, all grand. But we are fortunately using Unique Media's office today as a sort of lovely favour from them, so we can record there. And my guest today, he's got a really boring job title that means nothing compared to what he actually does. So he's officially the head of R&D device engineering at GSK, which doesn't really tell you anything at all. What he actually does is help millions of people to breathe every day, which sounds significantly cooler and more of a reason to not turn off this podcast. So joining me now on the line from where in Hertfordshire in the UK is Andy Dundon. Andy, how are you and welcome to Connected?
Very well.
Now, Andy, I understand before we get into all the cool stuff, you actually studied over here as well at some point in your younger days.
I did, yep. I studied analytical sciences at Dublin City University, which was NIHE Dublin at the time. My background really is that my parents were Irish, who emigrated to Scotland and then on to New Zealand and then came back to Scotland, and in 83 moved back to Dunleary, and I moved with them and went to university and then NIHE as it was.
So the one thing we've got in sort of mind here with you historically, familiarly, is you really like rain. And so, you know, that's a key part, in fairness, with learning about folk, because New Zealand, very similar to Glasgow and or pretty much most of Scotland that isn't Aberdeen, it's wet. And of course, we all know what Ireland's like for the weather. Now, Andy, we're not talking about the weather today, although I'm sure that affects a lot of the people you're helping because, you know, sort of climate and all that. We're talking about a thing which most people wouldn't think about, which is inhalers, because we're a tech podcast. We deal with some high-end stuff when it comes to tech. Most people just figure it's a pump and it works. Inhalers are way more complicated than that, aren't they, Andy?
They certainly can be, and it's more to do with is that they are relatively complex systems inside, but what we're trying to do is make it as easy as possible for the patient to actually use them.
And so tell us a bit about the work you've done in terms of making things easier, because, you know, anyone listening to this podcast, if they haven't used an inhaler themselves, they've definitely known someone who did. And the process always looks pretty similar. You pull the yolk out, you pump it, in it goes, you hear the little type noise, and stuff happens involving medicines, for want of a better way of phrasing it. Give us a bit more detail on the actual what we're not seeing and what's changed in the time you've been working on all of this.
So if you think about the history of these things, is that there's basically two broad families of inhaler-type devices that have been developed. There's the classical metered dose inhaler, the pressurized one that you've just described, which has got the gas in the system. And then there's the classical dry powder inhaler, which is actually using the patient's own inhalation maneuver to actually inhale. So those are the two classical different types. Is that both of them are very, very complex. One is the pressurized metered dose inhaler is probably very complex because you've got a relatively complex valve which is dealing with a relatively complex formulation, is where you're trying to keep that drug at the right particle size to actually deliver it into the lung and to reproducibly deliver the same dose through the life of the inhaler. The key challenges with those types of inhalers for some patient groups is that their ability to coordinate is the pressing and breathing. Hence why is the dry powder type inhaler was developed, is whereas you're using the patient's own effort to actually deliver the dose. So here is that you've got is either a reservoir of powder, or you might have is that the powder in a strip. It's where you've got multiple doses and you've got a relatively simple mechanism is to peel that strip, or is to present that powder from a reservoir is to the airflow path, and then the patient inhale. So that sounds relatively simple, but is that these are, you know, relatively complex mechanical systems in terms of is that I can think about the inhalers in GSK space, is that where we've been involved in that, is that where is our most recent inhaler has got is 27 components. Is 25 of those are plastic injection molded parts and two are springs, and we are manufacturing those types of devices at round about 100 to 120 devices a minute, So it's not very complex mechanical engineering, but is that we're using similar sorts of tools that you might use is that when you're designing aircraft, is with the objective of is making sure that these things are as mechanically robust as they can be, because patients' expectation is that these systems will work. So is that, you know, if you compare us in terms of the medical device space, we might have substantiated complaints where there's been real failure of less than 5 parts per million. Compare that to maybe to the mobile phone industry, where is they have much more complicated systems, but the customer complaint rate is where they've actually got failures is somewhere between 10 and 20,000 ppm.
And so, also, in fairness, if a mobile phone breaks, you've got a couple of people really, really annoyed. If an inhaler breaks, some people might actually die. So kind of a bit more serious, I suppose, as well.
And that's exactly the point, is why we're striving for that level of quality. So again, is that we're using, you know, very high-end engineering tools to understand the design space within which these systems actually work, is to minimise that potential is that something could go wrong in a patient's hands.
And now, one of the things I've noticed with the work you all are doing, because it's like sort of how inhaler technology is developing, because I'm sure most of the listeners, their first thought, especially those who don't use inhalers, like myself, who don't use them, only things I've been inhaling over the years have been terribly bad for me, I must admit. Although that said, one should always enjoy a fine cigar. But don't truly inhale. You let the flavor flow in your mouth and you let it out if you're having a cigar, folks. You don't truly inhale a cigar. But when it comes to sort of the technology behind it, most folk would assume it's not really changed in the last 60, 70 years. Now, I know in the mechanical side, that's also wrong, but digitally, things are looking up as well. I'll get to the mechanical in a bit, but you're looking at sort of Bluetooth and inhalers at the moment.
I'd answer the question differently in terms of is, I think people are thinking about digital is and some people are acting in the digital space, but I think what's really, really important is to actually understand is that what are the problems that we're trying to solve, yeah?
Yeah.
And then trying to understand is that what is the best solution to that problem? Now, that best solution might be a digital solution, but the really, really important part of what it is that we do is really defining as the problem statements and taking time to get those problem statements right, is because if you can get the problem statement right is that the ability to design stuff is relatively simple, is that oftentimes, lots of time and effort is wasted on a not well-defined problem statement where people think that they are solving the problem that's been described to them, but in actual fact, they aren't. So again, digital is something is that in the device space, especially in the inhaled device space, it's something is that we have been looking at for a number of years, yeah? But there are key challenges in terms of is, what exactly is the problem that it's actually addressing? And then, again, I think is that what we've got to be clear around is that who is the digital solution for? Is it for the entire patient population? Is it for a subset of the patient population? Is because, again, given the volume of manufacture of these products, is that we need to get a balance of in terms of is the cost that you're actually going to add to is something that is a monthly disposable delivery system, and is the environmental burden if you were to actually put it onto every single device. So you're moving from something that is plastic to something that now includes electronics and batteries, and it's really about is that how do we get that is balanced right in terms of is what's the problem, what subset of the patient population, or is it entirety of the population, and how do we get the balance right between cost and environmental burden?
And there's an awful lot there, but before I get into sort of, you know, addressing those questions, I think one thing, you know, when it comes to sort of why someone ends up doing their job, what led you to think, sure, this is an area I want to research? Like, I think that definitely jumps out as, you know, you went to NIHE, as we like to call it, eventually become DCU, and you ended up, there's so many routes in sort of, you know, biotech, in mechanics, in pharma, you could have gone down, you decided to end up here. How did you end up doing what you do, Andy?
I joined GSK not straight from university. There was a couple of jobs I did before that, but in 1988 I joined GSK, Glaxo as it was, I worked in the analytical space. I also worked on the start of the transition from NR meter dose inhalers, the ones that make the puff, moving from CFCs to propellant 134A. is driven by the Montreal Protocol, is to decrease the carbon footprint of those products. I then went and worked in is the tableting type space, for analytical formulation type space, and worked on a number of projects there, and then moved around is within, still within the product development space, and eventually decided that I wanted to go as we'd go on a secondment into the devices group. I thought that'd be really interesting for 6 months. I'd started that in 1999 and I've never left.
So it's a good 6 months since you've been doing.
Primarily I've never left is because it's probably, I find what we do in this space absolutely fascinating in terms of is the problem solving, and it's both the problem solving in regards to is the engineering and the fundamental understanding of the engineering is the how you translate is a design into a super high volume, high quality product, and also is that is a part about is the design for the patient interface. So it really goes to this thing about in terms of is there's three key things that we've really got to get right is it's around design for that patient population, it's around design for that mechanical robustness, and it's design for manufacturing robustness and quality. And it's really how you put those three pieces or key parts of the jigsaw together is to actually come up with something that is a truly robust, differentiated, and really importantly, patient-centric medicine.
And now, Andy, I'm just looking at sort of, you know, some of the various things you've got to answer in terms of queries when it comes to what's required to make this the right device. And one thing I was thinking of there was, you know, because I'm a pretty large dude, Andy. I'm about 6'3", 20 stone. So I'm not the smallest man alive. But oddly, I have the hands of a much healthier, smaller person. They're not exactly enormous. You know, hand size, I'm guessing, differentiates wildly across users, because they're not tiny hands, they're pretty average sized, you know, but they aren't those of a giant man you would expect like myself. I'm no Mike Ross out there, the old prop for Leinster with his enormous hands that he had, now actually working in a tech space, oddly. But when it comes to stuff like that, like, do you have to think about, you know, can this petite person use it versus like this giant Mike Ross person? Like, how do you make sure even like hand size is taken into account when it comes to, you know, the application of this?
So irrespective of whether it's an inhaled device or any device, yeah, the fundamental questions that we've kind of got to ask ourselves as we go through this is in terms of is that what type of disease is it? Is it acute, chronic, episodic, right? And again, why do I say that? Is because is that if it's acute, is that you probably want something that's incredibly simple, because if they're only going to use it once in their lives, yeah, it's because if they don't use it, they're dead, like an EpiPen. You need to make it as simple as possible. If it's chronic, you can actually possibly have something that's slightly more complicated, because they're going to be using it every day of their lives, yeah? Therefore, there is a built-in learning. If it's episodic, you kind of need to be somewhere in between the two. So you've got to ask yourself that sort of question is, who is the patient group in terms of exactly as you go? Is it mainly female? Is it mainly male? Is it certain parts of the world? Like, for example, cystic fibrosis is a disease that we talk about, but it's a disease of the Western world. It's not a disease of Asia, right? So again, you need to think about those sort of things. You need to think about is, you know, what are the patient's comorbidities? So is if they have other, if they've got a disease, are they likely to have other conditions? Is it likely to affect their motor skills in terms of what they can do with their hands? Does it affect their visual acuity in terms of what can they see? Do they have issues with cognitive function because of the disease that they have? Is it, what is the care setting? Is who is the caregiver? You ask yourselves all these questions to start the process of actually thinking about is, what is a product that would work in that target patient population. You give that sort of problem to your designers, your designers design, and then we go out and we do lots and lots of patient handling studies to actually observe what patients actually do. We do those patient handling studies in Europe, we do them in the US, and we do them in Japan to get that breadth of his patient input is from different cultures. And I mean, if you go to Japan, by default is you get smaller hand size.
And So that's the idea. You've got to think about all those areas, like, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, I'm thinking of the various, because you mentioned that's just one factor. Environmental.
Just one thing is that if people want to, go onto YouTube and type in Dr. House and asthma, and there is a part from that television series which shows what a patient is doing with a device, yeah? Now, I know it's a television program, right? But what we observe is, so if a designer sits in the isolation of their office, yeah, and designs, yeah, and doesn't go out and observe what people actually do in the real world is, they will make huge mistakes. Some of our greatest learnings are actually from watching what people do, because intuitively we think we understand what they are going to do. In reality, sometimes they do something almost extraordinary that you wouldn't imagine could happen. And that is a critical learning.
Because the design challenge here is really enormous when you think about it, Andy. I know you obviously do because it's literally your job to think about it, but we've mentioned the hands part. We've mentioned sort of, you know, getting the dosage correct. We've mentioned, you know, environmentally sound sides of things. We mentioned sort of the difference across regional use, the difference across physiological use. Like, there's so much stuff required, and thinking like, you know, the mathematics behind this must be off the charts. The, you know, design levels must be so much, you know, required, like, because all the stress and strain factor. Like, how do you guys take that holistic approach when you're trying to think of, you know, because you've got so many small questions to answer, all of which, because of the nature of the product, have to be answered correctly. And at the same time, you're also doing it in a situation where you're working with another department that's actually doing the research in the drugs in the first place. So what's sort of the process for you in making sure you keep that holistic view, that macro picture, to make sure that the end device is what it's going and what's needed?
Well, I suppose we've got a relatively well-mapped process that we go through, right? So again, as I said, there is that piece that's around designing for the target patient population, and there are certain things that we know that we are going to do. We know we're going to come up with concept designs. We know that we're going to take those concept designs out, and they may well just be foam models, is to actually go out to patients initially and healthcare professionals potentially and say, how does this look? How does it feel? We might then, the ones that win in that space, we might take them in and turn them into a prototype model, which would be basically a very functional model so that we could do some initial testing or some initial analysis to understand it. Is that design viable at all? Yeah. And then we will then take that design and develop it further and take that out into patient handling studies and start that process. And that patient handling process is something that we go back to all the way through the process. So as we make a change, yeah, we actually go back and check is that we actually haven't introduced another failure mode or people's perception of how things should work. So that's the patient side, is really thinking about patients. In terms of design for mechanical robustness, there are extraordinary modelling tools that exist now where we are able to model systems to actually understand and to stretch the design. And again, is part of the importance for us in that is quite interesting in terms of during clinical development is we don't actually have the opportunity to explore a lot of the design because we've actually only got small cavity tools. When we go to production scale, we're going to have really large cavity tools, and at that point is that we will use more of the tolerance ranges that are on our detailed engineering drawings. And we have the tools that enable us to model how is that we think critical functions in the device will work. So we can do it from first principles as well, so is that we've got applied mathematicians and applied physicists who can do that modelling by first principles. And then we can actually try to validate those models by actually making devices at the extremes of the design and understanding do they still perform as we would expect, so that we can actually start to validate the mathematical models we have. We use computational fluid dynamics, especially in our inhaled devices, to understand where does the air move, where does the powder move to, what level of energy are we putting into the powder, to actually de-aggregate it so that we can actually deliver it into the lungs. And then around the manufacturing assembly, the machines that we make are, and again, it's not GSK makes, we make them with our partners, who are some of the best assembly equipment manufacturing companies in the world. These are essentially the biggest go, no-go gauges in the world. Everything that you do, you have a station that checks that you've actually done it, right? So you do an action, you check it. You do the next action, you check it. What we do is that we can actually make stations that we are particularly concerned about is the robustness of them, we might make a prototype station and try to operate that at the speed that might happen to just observe what was happening. So a classical example might be is that you've got a gear train, a relatively complex gear train, and it moves along this line, but it has to stop between stations for the next thing to happen. At that stop, you might actually see, if you use slow motion video cameras, is that the gears might jump and actually go out of alignment with each other. And again, is that, you know, on these devices, is that we might have multiple gears in a gear train, and we would reject the part if one gear on that gear train was one gear tooth out.
Right.
And that's what those machines are capable of doing.
That is some really, really refined, tight, tight stuff. Now, one thing as well is like I was like trying to sort of put sort of the historical context with stuff. So my dad's 84. He uses inhalers because he's 84. Come on. The people that age typically do, unless they're utter health freaks. What's different with the inhaler he's using, say, today, typically in terms of what's going on inside of it, compared to, say, the one he'd been using, say, when he was 74, maybe even when he was 70?
Oh, sorry. The difference between the inhalers today, I think, is that... The formulation technology has potentially moved on. But in terms of the mechanics within the system, they haven't changed. Is that what we have been driving to do is trying to make the patient interface simpler and simpler and simpler. So again, if you look back historically, is that the first medicines in this space were rescue medicines, yeah? So is that as you had an asthma attack, is that you would take those medications, and that would be give you relief so that you could breathe. Where the medicines have evolved in terms of is that there have been new classes of molecules which have given a longer duration of action. So rather than just being a rescue, we've now got maintenance therapies. Those maintenance therapies is where we've now moved into combinations of those maintenance therapies. Make it easier for patients to be compliant with a medication. We've moved from doses which were twice daily to once daily, again to drive simplicity. We've moved to simpler devices in terms of their ability to actually access a dose. So again, some of the earlier devices were potentially more complex to use in terms of the original unit dose. Is dry powder inhalers is that you had to load the dose yourself. You had to load it the right way round. You had to break the capsule a certain way. You had to breathe in, and then you had to dispose of it and do that whole action again. So the number of operations to actually get your dose was actually quite high. Now in the more modern dry powder inhalers, it's as simple as open, inhale, and close. So I don't think it's in terms of the device mechanical engineering has fundamentally changed. I think it's really about how have we simplified that to give patients the best opportunity to access their medicine as we intended them to.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense actually, Andy. Yeah, because I'm thinking it's the UX you've basically worked on so much, which is kind of interesting as well, given like sort of the digital side I brought up earlier about sort of, you know, possible Bluetooth and the likes. One area which comes up a lot when I'm talking to people in sort of the medical space, and I'd love to get your view on this, is quite often there's this urge to add digital where it's almost like, you know, let's find something digital first and then see what it solves later. I suppose one of the things you're trying to keep people to bear in mind when you're working from your side is, let's see what the problem is, and the solution, be it digital or not, is it should be sort of, you know, it should be agnostic on, so to speak.
Yeah, that's exactly my point as I'm trying to make, was in terms of is that oftentimes is trying to fit a technology to a problem is actually really bad practice. What you'd be far better to do is to really understand the problem and then understand what is the best solution. And that best solution may be digital, but I tell you what, we're going to do digital now, right? That is, in my experience, that is bad design practice, is to actually try to fit a technology to a problem. You're far better to define the problem and then fit the right solution to the problem.
That's brilliant. Andy, before we wrap up, I just want to give you a chance to plug your pluggable. So if you want to learn more about the work you do and what you're working on, where's the best place to go to reach out and find out about that?
The best places possibly is to contact me, because I do this in the UK, is I do go to certain universities and I do give a presentation, and the reason I do it, right, is that oftentimes is that students and design students don't actually understand that this type of function exists within a big pharma company, and therefore is actually finding it quite difficult to recruit people. So I do it is because I want people to understand is that the type of role that I'm describing does exist within Big Pharma, and it is an absolutely fascinating job to have because of the complexity of is the patient, the mechanics and the manufacturing is that makes it really, really interesting.
And because Andy mentioned those two words and we are a podcast, therefore there are at least two conspiracy theorists ready to jump on us on the internet at all times with crazy, crazy thoughts. Yes, yes, it is a big pharmaceuticals company. Guess what? My apartment floor, if you saw it, you'd realize they are not paying me any money. This is not some crazy false flag or whatever other stupid terms you want to use. Instead, Andy has been really, really helpful to us in giving this fascinating insight into what is a very everyday technology that everybody uses. But if you are a conspiracy theorist, go, I don't know, listen to The Corrs or something. I don't really care. On that note, we are sadly wrapping up. We have some housekeeping to do before we get to the wrap-up fully, though. And that is, as you've noticed, we haven't had episodes in a while. That's not an accident. We've got a couple in the can as well. We're going to have a run-in, basically post-Web Summit through a few things. Now that we've got the new office and the new move, we are going to be putting a few together in a sort of 3-4 week span. It'll go out, obviously, over more like a 10-12 week span. And once we've got that all down, we will be back at a regular service, which will be a nice change after our last year, a very incidental when are you releasing an episode type of production schedule. So for Connected as ever, we've got an issue out this weekend if we're releasing in time, possibly last weekend, depending on when this got edited. But I'm off to the Web Summit, so there'll be lots coming from that. Keep an eye on that on both businesspost.ie and obviously in the main paper itself. And in Connected, the next issue after this, if this is out after Sunday the 4th, will be the first Sunday in December, and I've no idea what date that is, but it is the first Sunday in December, so just keep an eye out for that. As ever, Connected is brought to you in association with Dell EMC, and of course we literally couldn't do that show without their support, so thanks y'all, it really does come in handy. And until next time, I would like to thank my guest Andy Dundon, who is of course again the head of R&D device engineering with GSK, and more importantly went to DCU, and I will keep being Emmett Ryan.